I hope you're having a fantastic Friday and that you're looking forward to a great weekend and a weekend that includes time spent with your brothers and sisters in Christ. We all need a local congregation, a place where we can gather and worship and fellowship and pray and praise and serve and learn and encourage, because that's the way it's supposed to work. If you don't have a place like that that you're attending regularly, you need to go out and find one. If you're actively looking for some place like that right now and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, we invite you to come and check us out as a potential home congregation. We'd love to see you. Fridays, I also often want to say thank you to those of you who are supporting Into the Word financially. Some of you are making sure that we stay on this radio station. Others of you are making sure that we stay on the internet and we're available to those far, far away around the world. Thank you both ways for doing all of that. God bless you for it, and may God increase your number. Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to, I believe we'll go to 2 Samuel chapter number 7 as our base text. But you should be aware that a lot of the stories we're telling now have a parallel in the Chronicles. So 1 Chronicles chapter 17 is the parallel for what we're about to look at today. 2 Samuel chapter 7 apparently takes place not too terribly long, maybe a few years, after the Ark of God's throne, his covenant Ark, has been brought by David to Jerusalem, the new capital city, and placed in a tent in the palace courtyard, there in the north end of the ancient city of David. So David apparently is sitting in his upgraded palace that was gifted to him by Hiram. And that palace included apparently really nice paneling made from cedar wood, made from the cedars of Lebanon. And he has got it in his head that it's not right that he, as a human king, has a better place to sit on his throne than God does. And so here's how it's expressed and starts our story. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1. Now, when the king lived in his house, and he who is had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies, the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent." And David said to the king, "Go, do all that's in your heart, for he who is with you." Now, we have to tweak Nathan just a tiny bit here. He's a good man. He's a prophet of God. But he jumps the gun on something here. He assumes that his own feelings toward David and David's desire reflect God's feelings toward David's desire. And they don't. He should have checked in with God first. So because he didn't, God has to get after him a little bit and instruct him to go and correct the record for David. So this is what we read, verse 4 of 2 Samuel 7. "But that same night, the word of he who is came to Nathan," probably in a dream, "Go and tell my servant David, thus says he who is, would you build me a house to dwell in?" And that's it's a rhetorical question, and in this case, it expects a negative answer, that David's not the guy. "I've not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this very day." And we're talking about 450-some years. "But I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, 'Why haven't you built me a house of cedar?'" Again, a little rhetorical instruction here. We've gone through the period of the judges, and not a single one of God's judges has been told by God, "Hey, How come you haven't built me a palace yet? Why is my Ark of the Covenant, my throne, still sitting in a tent?" And of course, God didn't say that to any of them. Verse 8, "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David." So, Nathan, here is what I want you to tell David, not what you told him. This is what I want him told. "Thus says he who is over the armies." In the Hebrew, it's Yahweh Tzabaoth. It is God's military title. It shows up a lot in this period of Israeli history. It's all about God being in command. He's in charge. "I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel." There's some play on words here because he just talked about how the judges of the period of the judges were acting as the shepherds of Israel. So God says, "David, you remember? You used to be a shepherd, and I grabbed you from that position and turned you into the shepherd of Israel. I've been with you wherever you went. I've cut off all your enemies from before you, and I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth." So I'm going to make you famous, even more famous than you already are because of the things I've already done for you. Verse 10, "And I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel." Now, folks, those lines right there should be understood in their ultimate application. Because even under David and under Solomon and under all the other kings of Israel that reigned out of Jerusalem, they had problems. They had issues. They had a lack of peacefulness. Even when they came back from their Assyrian and Babylonian exiles and they put Jerusalem back together again, they still had problems. They still had a lack of peace. And they end up going into exile again. And even when many ethnic Israelis have come back in droves to the Holy Land, the Promised Land, and they have taken Jerusalem back underneath, for the most part, their control, they still don't have this peace here. They have not been planted permanently just yet. So the only time that these couple of phrases here will be fully fulfilled is when the last trumpet is sounded, the skies are split, Jesus Christ appears as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and he resurrects and transforms all his people from time immemorial and brings them together to him to the new heaven and new earth in which righteousness will dwell. And he sits upon the throne of Israel permanently as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, apparently at the site of Jerusalem in the new earth. That's the only time that this passage will be in its complete fulfillment. And so this is not simply about the Davidic line of the history of Israel we're looking at in Samuel and Chronicles and the rest of the Old Testament. I just want you to be aware of that. So, we're in verse number 10. We're going to continue it. "And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, he who is declares to you that he who is will make you a house." Now, this is a bit of a metaphorical application of the word house, because the Davidic line is the one from which Mashiach, Yehoshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah, will arise. He's the one that will sit upon the throne of Israel forever. And he is the one that will have the peacefulness over this house forever. And so this is where we have prophetic elements that have multiple ways of being understood, being introduced into the text here. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled, meaning when you are old and die, and you lie down with your fathers, his body will be placed in a tomb, and his spirit will go to be with the spirits of the righteous ones in his family that have passed away. I will raise up your seed, your offspring, after you. And I make sure that you understand that that's part of the seed promise that goes all the way back to Eve and Adam, that one of their seed was going to rise up and crush the head of the serpent. But also, Abraham was told, in your seed, Abraham, all the nations, all the goyim, all the ethnic groups of the earth are going to be blessed. And Paul, writing on that very topic in the book of Galatians, said that word seed there is singular on purpose because it applies to Jesus, the singular seed that fulfills all those prophecies. And so I want you to make sure you bring that into the context here. So I will raise up your seed after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So there is a Jesus element to this prophecy here. There is a millennial and eternal application of this prophecy that we should take in consideration. But there is also underlying that a much more near prophecy about a son that will be born to him later. This new son is not going to come up for quite a few years yet. This son is going to have issues. And so that comes up into the next bit of the prophecy. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. That can apply to the Jesus fulfillment of this prophecy, but the next part can't. When he commits iniquity, because of course, Jesus was tempted in all ways like unto ourselves, but without sin. Book of Hebrews is very clear on that. So are many other passages of the New Testament. So this part can't be about Jesus. It is about Shlomo in particular, Solomon. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. So I will get after him. And God does this not just simply with Solomon, but with a sequence, a series of the sons of David who serve as the kings of Israel. He gets after them. He disciplines them. But my chesed, my steadfast love, will not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Now, what it means there is that the kingdom is not going to leave the David dynasty like it left the dynasty of Saul. It doesn't matter how bad David's descendants are in administering the kingdom of Israel from here on out, God will never revoke the royal right that is in the line of David, in the line of Judah, in the line of Israel, in the line of Isaac, in the line of Abraham, in the line of Adam and Eve. It will always remain in that very specific genetic line. And Jesus, of course, is the terminal point of that prophecy. Verse 16, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. So David's sons, over the time of the history that, Lord willing, we'll get to in this sixth time through the entirety of God's inspired word, we will see God terminate that right to rule. The line of Solomon will have a curse put on it by God himself, saying, no one from this line will ever be allowed to rule over the throne of Israel ever again. And Jesus doesn't come from the Solomon ethnic line. That's not his gene group. He comes from Solomon's younger brother, Nathan. That's a story for another day. But this is the promise to David that once the throne is in the house of David, it will always be in the house of David. And once the ultimate king arrives, he will always be on this eternal throne. And so Nathan receives all that information. He goes to David, and he talks about it. Verse 17, in accordance with all these words and in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. Now, there was more to it than what we just read, and the reason we know that is because David speaks of additional items that were included in this talk. And the most key among those items I need to mention right now, and that is that God had Nathan tell David that he would not be allowed to build this house, this palace in honor of God, because he was a man of war. He was a man of blood. That instead, it would be one of his sons who was a man of peace, a man who had not shed blood and not been involved in war, who would build the house. And guess what? That will be Solomon, whose name in Hebrew, Shlomo, specifically means peaceful one. And he will be a kid still. I mean, when he comes to the throne, he'll be in his teens. And when his father dies, he apparently is still in his teens. And when he builds the temple very early on, he will be in his 20s, and he will not have been involved in any wars whatsoever. And so David is told by Nathan from God the specific reason you're not allowed to do this thing that you want to do is because you are a warrior, and I want a peaceful man building this palace, this temple. Now, I emphasize that because it is still common practice amongst the tour guides in Israel, and I think I've seen it among some commentators as well, that the reason David was not allowed to build the temple was because of his adultery with Bathsheba, and that is not true. It is not accurate. His adultery fail does not happen for several years after this event that we're looking at right now. It's because he's a warrior and God wants this building built by a person who's never been at war. Verse number 18, let's talk about David's response. Then King David went in and sat before he who is. I believe that means he went out to the courtyard, entered into this tent that he's erected over the royal area for God, I think he goes in there and he sits down somewhere where he can see the Ark of the Covenant, God's throne. And then he prays, "Who am I? Oh, he who is Elohim, he who is God. What's my house that you've brought me thus far?" So David begins his prayer session by acknowledging, "God, you are right. I was a nobody. And yet, verse 19, this was a small thing in your eyes, O he who is God, that is to make me king, to bring me from being a shepherd in a family down at Bethlehem to this point where I am sitting in this majestic city, in a majestic palace, as the king of a majestic people. That's a really big deal for me. You have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come. And this is instruction for mankind, O he who is God." So you've not just simply given me what I have right now. You've also told me that my dynasty will last into eternity, and that one of my descendants will be an eternal king. I don't know how that works. I'm sure that's what's going through his head. I don't understand how that works, but I know if you say it, it's true. Verse 20, "And what more can David say to you? For you know your servant, O he who is God. Because of your promise, and according to your own heart, you have brought about all this greatness to make your servant know it. Therefore, you are great, O he who is God. There is none like you. There is no God beside you. According to all that we've heard with our ears." So he goes into a praise session here. "Who is like your people Israel? The one ethnic group, the one nation on earth whom God went to redeem to be his people, making himself a name and doing for them great and awesome things by driving out before your people whom you redeemed for yourself from Egypt, a nation and its gods." Very often praise is historical in format. And that's exactly what David does here. He goes, "You came down to Egypt and brought us out as a people group. You redeemed us with a very mighty hand. And then you took us through the wilderness and you brought us into the promised land and you chased out people before us and you chased out the gods that those people had." Verse number 24, "And you establish for yourself your people Israel to be your people forever. And you, O he who is, became their God." So here we have David saying, it is amazing. You, the Creator God, chose us, the Israeli people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to become your special people in this special place. "Now, O he who is God, confirm forever the word you've spoken concerning your servant and concerning his house, and do as you have spoken." So please keep your promise. "Your name will be magnified forever, saying, he who is over the armies is God over Israel, and the house of your servant David will be established before you." And that's all true, because here we are. Here we are, 3,000 years after David, still talking about this and looking forward to the fulfillment of Jesus coming and bringing it to its ultimate completion. "For you, O he who is over the armies, the God of Israel, have made this revelation to your servant, saying, I will build you a house. Therefore, your servant has found courage to pray this prayer to you. And now, O he who is God, you are God. Your words are true. You have promised this good thing to your servant. Now, therefore, Now, therefore, may it please you to bless the house of your servant so that it may continue forever before you. So again, David is in praise mode, and he basically is just thanking God and saying, and now may everything you say come true. Make my dynasty, my family, a blessed one. And may I see that young man born into my household sometime hereafter be the one that builds that temple. For you, O he who is God, have spoken, and with your blessing shall the house of your servant be blessed forever. And so David, as is his character at this time, just offers to God praise and honor and glory, and I suspect probably writes several psalms to kind of go along with his thinking at this time. And we'll get to some of those psalms, I think, in a section that's coming up soon where we'll spend a lot of time in the psalms. But first, we need to talk about the expansion of the Davidic kingdom, the Israeli kingdom, to its promised land borders. And that starts with the chapter 8 of 2 Samuel and chapter 18 of 1 Chronicles, where David's military expansion is described in not quite detail, but well enough that we can see the borders go to the ends of the promised land, parameters made to Abraham by God. I think we're just going to break it off here, mark our place, and invite you to come back next time we have opportunity to get into God's inspired word.